It went straight down the middle. Then it started to hook.
All right, welcome to another edition of For the Good of the Game. And Bruce, I have two thoughts today as we get ready to introduce this guest. First, I don't know that we've had too many guests with the broad body of work that this fella has amassed throughout his entire career. And secondly, he's the only guest we've had that I'm sure can name the starting lineup for the 1964 St. Louis Cardinals.
Well, that hits very close to home. Now, you've sort of given away who we've got today, but to back up what you just said, here's a man that made the cut 79 times in 92 majors, won three U.S. Opens, had 83 victories worldwide, 45 of them coming as a Champions Tour winner. And it is indeed a great pleasure to have with us today, Hale Lew. And Hale, thanks for joining Mike and I.
Well, Bruce, it's been a while since you and I have connected, and it's wonderful to talk about some of the old times, the old players, and how that's morphed into today's game, which is a very exciting and dynamic game, different than what you and I played, certainly, but dynamic nevertheless.
Great to have you this morning. How many of those starters in 64 can you remember, Hale?
Oh, 64.
New York, you know, beat the Yankees in 7 games.
I think we had, what's his name at third base? Another guy at shortstop.
Well done, Bill.
I think Shanahan was at third.
Yeah. Actually, by then, Mike Shannon was in right field because Kenny Boyer was playing third, right?
There's that other guy.
Who's on first?
That's the other guy.
Yeah. Who was on second?
Javier was on second base. And, of course, Bob Gibson on the mound. You'll never forget the great Bob Gibson.
He damn near single-handedly won that. Boy, the way he pitched and with very short rest. And, I'd hate to face that man.
Before we get to your career and growing up and everything, one quick Bob Gibson stat, which you probably know. Bob Gibson pitched in 3 World Series, pitched 9 games. How many innings do you think he pitched in 9 games?
He was, I would guess, if it wasn't a full complement of 81 innings, it would be very close.
It was 81 innings.
Yep.
And 7 9-inning games, he pitched 1 game, 8 innings, and went 10 innings in the other.
Right.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
You never see that.
He was a marvelous athlete.
Anyway, as Bruce said, we've got the great Hale Irwin with us today, and so delighted to have him. And Hale, as we've talked about, we're here to tell your story, and that generally begins at the beginning. So your story sort of at least starts with birth in Joplin, Missouri, as I understand. Why don't you just take us through growing up as a young man?
Oh, boy. Well, my mother was an Okie. My father lived in Southwest Missouri. He was a bit older than she, and my parents, after they married, they lived in Miami, Oklahoma, which is in the very north east corner of Oklahoma. But the nearest hospital, I guess, I say that because I'm not sure Miami had a hospital, but Joplin, Missouri did. And maybe that's where her doctor practiced, but that's where I was born, in Joplin, Missouri. I never lived there, but other than those few days as born, and I lived in Miami as a baby. And then we moved just across the line into Baxter Springs, Kansas, shortly thereafter. And that's where I grew up. In fact, I've got some pictures over here on the wall of that little 9-hole dirt sand green golf course where I played. But St. Louis Cardinals were my favorite team then, Mike. My next door neighbor, he listened to Harry Carey on the radio every day, and he'd sit under his shade tree and listen to Harry Carey, and I'd go out there and listen with him. But I got into all the neighborhood stuff. It's a small town. Baseball was part of it. You know, sandlot football was part of it. Pickup basketball games were part of it. But golf was something I could do on my own. My father played. He wasn't a pro. He played rarely, but he did take old clubs. He'd cut the shafts, wrap the shaft in electrical tape, and that's how I kind of got started with just a few clubs. But I enjoyed it because I didn't need somebody else to play catch with or to shoot with, or I could do that on my own. And he would take me out to this little course every now and again, and I liked it. And then as I got a little older, my mom would take me out there with a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and leave me most of the day and come and get me later on to go to baseball practice or whatever it was. And that's just kind of where I fell in love with the game. And there are pictures up on the wall here of me at age 4 with a golf club. Now, I've never had a lesson. So those are just raw, this is what it was like, lessons. I mean, swing. But we moved to Colorado, to Boulder, Colorado, when I was 14. Went 8th grade on. And my love of the game, I was still playing baseball. That was sort of the game that golf transcended all the games ultimately, but baseball kind of kept me going. And my uncle sponsored a team, and I got into that. But we initially we stayed in a little efficiency motel right across the street from a daily golf course, and I ended up going over there to caddy. And I would take those caddy earnings of $2.75 for a single, and I would go pay $2.25 for greens fees, and they'd leave me 50 cents to have a drink. But that's how I got started. There was no range, so you played.
Yeah, yeah.
Caddy, then I'd go pay and play. And that's it just evolved, and I don't need to get into all those details, but each year got a little better than the next and the next, and into high school, and played football and basketball and golf in the spring. And as all kids do, they improve in whatever they're doing, and they grow, and they mature, and football became my way into college. I got a full-ride scholarship to play football at the University of Colorado. I didn't know where my golf was going. No idea. But it was always the common denominator in every season. And so I look at football as I very much enjoyed it. I had some great teammates, you know, great long-lasting friendships are made. But every injury I got, I'd limp out or I'd run out to the golf course to see if that affected my swing any. Uh-huh. And I wish some of them would have, but so ultimately, I was the back of my mind, and Bruce knows this as well. Back then, you couldn't really talk about being a professional because the rules stated your intent, you became a professional.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And so you had to kind of keep it all inside. And I wanted to kind of talk about it. I did, by virtue of a stroke of luck, my football coach, he called Dow Fensterwald down at the Broadmoor, and I went down there to see Dow. And, you know, Dow said, can you hit a hook? Can you hit a fade? Can you hit it low? Can you hit it high? You know, those things that you try to do, and you can make no comment on whether someone's going to succeed. But, you know, I felt good that I could hit the shots that Dow asked me to hit. But it wasn't – I did win the NCAA golf tournament my senior year, and that was the catalyst that said, hey, at least I can win against – my peer group. I didn't get to play a lot of golf in the summer. I worked as a laborer. I had a job. So I didn't get to play a lot of golf. But that was a catalyst that said, let's go down to the PGA qualifying school and see if you can make it. And the rest is history.
Yeah. And a lot of history that is too. Boy, what a great career. Hale, you mentioned something that a lot of our players that we've spoken to have mentioned, and that is that they've played another sport.
Mm-hmm.
Not only one, maybe two or three sports. Mm-hmm. They all feel that was a great benefit for them to relative to golf. Do you have any thoughts in that regard?
I do, Bruce. I have tried to counsel every kid I can, certainly every parent, every coach, to let those kids go do other things if they want. I think it's great cross-training, not only physically but mentally. I think it's great to be on a team where you understand your position in the team, but still, if you don't do your job, the team breaks down.
There you go.
But golf is such an individual sport that I think that kind of training really helps, vice versa. And I think the hand-eye coordination from any of the other sports is great. The physical conditioning in all the other sports lends itself to golf. So while kids want to, I would say let them. Don't get in their way, because as you know and I know, the stairway to the top of any sport, but particularly in golf, is littered with the corpse of many wannabes.
There you go.
And
that's right.
And you really, education is number one. Get that education, because that will help you make the right determination of where you're going to go in your life. And secondly, do all the sports. And they will fall by the wayside themselves. You'll find the ones that you want to do. It doesn't matter. You'll find your way into the endeavor in which you want to go. And if golf's it, well, you've got so much good training from the other sports. Swimming is a great sport. Now, is football the way to go? Maybe, if you really like it. Yeah, you can't deny it. Basketball, baseball, all those other ones, they're great to do it.
So, Hal, when you went to qualifying school, did you make it easily, or was it a battle?
Well, this was the first school that was held in the spring. As you well know, back in your day, Bruce, I don't know if they had even had qualifying schools. It may be if you were a PGA member, you could come out and play. But there had to be some credentials to get out there. But this was the first spring school.
Right.
I think there may have been a couple of fall schools prior to this. But when I reported down there, there were over 100 players. I think there were like 120. And we were vying for 15 spots. And the schedule for the week was we played 18 on Thursday, 18 on Friday, 36 on Saturday, a rest day on Sunday, 18 on Monday, 18 on Tuesday, 36 on Wednesday.
Boy.
To determine who was going to make. Well, you know, for me, I'm just coming out of football. I physically felt great. Now, would my golf game prove to be sufficient enough to get one of those cards? Well, it did. I think I finished fifth or sixth, maybe, or seventh. It didn't matter. I got one of those valued 15 spots. Bob Dixon was in that, if you remember Bob, of course. He led that qualifying. He was a U.S. Amateur British Open or British Amateur Champion at the same time. And Jim Thorpe's brother, Chuck Thorpe, was leading going to the last day. And Bob caught him, but it didn't matter. B.R. McClendon, Randy Wolf, those guys.
Right.
All good friends. And once I got onto the tour, which was several weeks later in Memphis in 1968, I saw all you good players, and I was just, oh, my, have I got a lot of work to do. Oh, boy, I thought it was hard before. It looks impossible now.
How did your game develop as a young man up until that time in 1968 when you turned up for qualifying school? Was it a steady progression, or were there some step changes that you really found, had some breakthroughs in certain aspects of your game?
Well, Micah, it's a good question, and I'm not sure I can adequately answer it because, as I said, my golf was rather cyclical in that living in Colorado, really developing my game, if you wish, as a teenager was in Colorado, and it can be a seasonal challenge. But when I was in high school playing golf or playing football in the fall, well, you know, maybe I'd get on that odd Saturday if it was nice and play a few holes, or that odd weekend. Same during the basketball. Now, once you get into spring in Colorado, it can still be dicey. My game, and I didn't ever have a teacher. Now, in a lot of respects, I think that was probably the single best thing that ever happened to me as far as professional goes, because I learned what I could do, and I could adapt on the fly versus perhaps some of today's players, which are told what to do and can't adapt until they get back into their coach. You know, I wanted someone like the devil to talk to me because he is a proven winner. He was there. And I would have a hard time listening to somebody else. But anyway, be that as it may, my development kind of came not so much in a great short game and then long game came around later. No, it just all kind of evolved at the same time because I didn't have a year-round opportunity to play. It was more intense during the springtime, and then I'd start working in the summer, and I'd get to play some state tournaments. But if I took any time off, my dad and my uncle who owned the company, I had to make up that time in overtime. So There were no freebies. There was no freeway in there. As much as I cajoled and pleaded, no. No, you make up the time.
Get back to work, boy.
Back to work was it. So I think the intensity was probably more ground into me, and Bruce will speak to that, as my intensity sometimes gets in my own way. But that was, I had a short period of time which developed my skills, and that's what I had to do.
As you got into the professional game, was there anything that you just sort of said, you know what, there's an aspect of my game I didn't realize how much I need to step up to compete at this level?
Hear that? That's the sound of a walk-off albatross, a two on a par five to win a two-day golf tournament. That shot happened to me, one in 600 million odds. Since then, people call me Albie. Now, I've told this story so often, my friends can't take it. I'm pretty sure my wife, next time I tell her, she's going to leave me. So I decided to start a podcast to tell the entire world about it because it deserves it. It's the craziest shot you've never heard of. And guess what? There's tons more stories like this all around golf. And that's what our podcast is all about. Join me and my fellow degenerates, Panda and Shepherd, as we dive into them. Insane bets, crazy what-if scenarios, and all the you-had-to-be-there type moments in golf. Find us wherever you get your podcast. Did I Tell You About My Albatross?
Well, I always felt, and this kind of goes back to my athletic career, Mike, is that no one was ever going to out-try me. They could beat me, but they weren't going to try harder than I did. I would never give up, ever. That doesn't mean that I won, but I wasn't going to give up. And that meant I couldn't give up on myself either. But I knew I had a lot of things to learn. And I use this example quite often. I think it was perhaps my second year on the tour. We were in Toronto at the Canadian Open. And I had a bad, this was when I was a Monday qualifier. So I really needed to make those cuts to move on to the next event. And I was walking back to my car, and I just went by the practice tee, and I just stopped and went out there, and I was looking at the first player, and I don't know who it was. And then I moved to the second player, and I went, and I was watching, let's say Bruce was there, or George Arch, or Arnie, it doesn't matter. And I just built this composite of, hey, I like that grip, I like that takeaway, I like that stance, I like that posture. I just built this composite in my head of a good golf game that I could use.
Yeah.
Not that I was ever going to get my hands high. I wouldn't have the flying elbow like Jack, but things about it, you have to understand that he's the greatest player ever played, and he had to do something well, so look for it.
Yeah, find it.
And anyway, I came out the next day, and I played really well, and that was the best thing I think I've ever done, is that I walked away from it with a very positive idea of what I wanted to do. Now, did I incorporate it exactly? No. But the influences, I think, really helped me. And as I got more experience and more confidence and more success, it kind of built upon itself.
On this idea you mentioned about watching other players, I'll ask each of you, was there a player or more than one player that as you got going professionally, you would stop, take notice, and watch them hit balls? They were that good.
Go ahead, Bruce.
I'm laying back here waiting for you. Well, I like to watch him because he was such a great player. I go back to my early days, obviously, and Peter Thompson probably. Mm-hmm. Probably I looked at him. I never spent a lot of time with him, and I never ever got a lesson from him, but a little bit like what Hale said, you know, you could see the fluency in that man's swing. He never hit the ball very crooked, so that was, you know, that was nice if you can sort of play this game without hitting it off the fairway.
Right.
A man at his time was also a very good player. Swung it differently was Norman Van Nijder, who was a guy that actually I spent my early years as a professional with him. He's the one that helped me the most, but I used to love to watch Peter Thompson swing the golf club.
Well, Peter, he's one of the icons, I think, of yesteryear. There'd be no doubt you could learn an awful lot from Peter. And whereas I didn't get to be around him as you did, Bruce, I did see him and primarily at the Open Championship. But I agree completely. But for me, I looked at attitude as much as I looked at anything else. Because I think being in the other sports, there were a lot of good athletes. And it seemed to me like every time I was around a guy with a great attitude, he became at least a good, if not great, player at his position. So his attitude, how did you believe in yourself? How did you motivate yourself to do that? And so I always like to look at the players, their attitude, how they went about doing what they do. And then I would look at their physical characteristics. What was it that made them good? I enjoyed watching you, Bruce. I really did. And I'll tell you why, because I like the tempo you had and I like the way you set the club. You didn't have the long swing, but you set right there. But you know what I'm talking about. You set it. The golf swing, in my opinion, starts the moment you set at the top. That's the golf swing from there down. How you get it back doesn't matter. I like to watch George Newton. You know, George, just easy going, smooth. George Archer, for a guy as big as George was, I love watching how he got to the ball, how he used his legs to power himself through it at 6'6". What's he do to make himself so good? And, of course, you look at Arnie. I think Arnie's grip was, Arnie's grip just went right on the club.
Yeah.
But I think there are just so many of those players, I just take that snapshot and remember that. And just a real quick thing on grip. I was at the Masters one year. I'd played the practice round by myself. I was coming off the 18th hole. I'll just go over and play the par three. I think it was on a Tuesday. And I got to the first hole to par three just as Gene Sarazen and Byron Nelson were getting there. And they asked if I'd like to join them. Would I like to join them?
Yeah.
Absolutely, I'd like to join them. Well, that little nine holes, we went around an hour or whatever, was absolutely delightful because those guys really knew how to hold that club. And you could see when they had to play with that old equipment, those old whippy hickories or those whippy steel shafts and those heavy irons, how they played with that and how they used their hands. Wow. And I was sorry that day ended. But it's things like that that just I tried to pick up on and put them back here in the memory bank if I didn't lose them in there and try to accommodate my own skills with what I've seen. And it was such a positive influence, and that's kind of how it all developed.
Before we jump into your professional career, I want to double back just for the benefit of our listeners who are listening to it this year or 50 years from now and want to know a little bit more about Hale Irwin. He was absolutely a star athlete in high school and college long before he was a star in golf. Quarterbacked his high school team in Boulder to a state championship. Played baseball and golf. He was in the Colorado High School Athletic Hall of Fame at the University of Colorado. He was an Athletic Hall of Fame member, inducted in 2002. Football player, hell of a football player, two-time All-Big Eight defensive back and academic All-American to boot. He won two Big Eight golf conference championships, and as he mentioned, won the 1967 NCAA Division I individual championship. And by the way, I think that was the year after you played your first U.S. Open, wasn't it?
It was. I played in San Francisco Olympic Club in 1966 as an amateur. Did I learn there?
I was going to say, because there was a few years before you then played your next one. That had to be a wonderful experience for you.
Oh, it was fantastic. Well, the thing that I remember the most, and I just have these little quick little snapshots of what I saw. Walking through the pro shop there at Olympic Club and looking up the first tee, Tony Lima. Tony was right there on the tee. Now, I didn't get to play with Tony ever. Bruce, you knew Tony, but I knew more of Tony. I think I met him, but I really didn't know Tony. And shortly thereafter, he died in that plane crash. There was a guy that had one of those rhythmic swings that you, and I remember going out and thinking, this is the hardest course I've ever seen. You know, rough, but you know, I knock on wood, I made the cut. And I remember saying, hey, I beat Chichi Rodriguez because Chichi didn't make the cut. I beat Chichi. But I just made it on the nose, and I played the next day, first out, with Gene Borick, who is from the East Coast. Wonderful guy. And the USGA guys were on that tee, really kind of in our face, saying, hey, you're the Rabbits. We're going to time you on every hole. We're going to be there, making sure, you know, just scared the you-know-what out of me. I don't want to be late. Man, I've never played a faster 18 holes in my life than I did that day. I learned a lot about how to play tough golf courses that week. Yeah.
That week, you would have loved to have had played a practice round or two with me. You know why? You'd have got to play practice rounds with Mr. Ben Hogan.
Oh.
Would you have loved that?
That would have been fantastic. I met Mr. Hogan one time and one time only. On the first tee at Colonial one year, I went up there, and as he was sitting at a table, and I introduced myself, said, "Oh, Mr. Hogan, I'm Hale Irwin." And that's all he said. "I know who you are." And that was it.
Sounds like him.
And he did, too. He knew who you were.
That was it. End of conversation. Okay.
That's the U.S. Open where you and Gloria flew out with he and his wife, didn't you, and had dinner?
Yeah, we flew out with them, and we stayed at the what used to be the Top of the Mark Hotel, which was a bit fancy for me in those days to stay at that hotel. And then we had dinner every night with the Hogans and played every practice round with him. I mean, it was one of the great, wonderful weeks in my life to have spent that much time and listened. I guess I made a mistake, sort of. I said on the Monday night dinner, I said, "Mr. Hogan, I know you probably don't like to talk about it, but what actually happened that afternoon when you left El Paso, you know, on your way back to Fort Worth?" And Monday night at dinner and Tuesday night at dinner, before he finished the story of walking up the 18th hole at Marion. Mm. So it was, talk about a 20-month history of what went on was so vivid, Hale, so vivid.
Well, you know, speaking of Marion, and I had heard this, and maybe you can corroborate it or dispel it, that where they have the plaque there now, he hits his one iron to that green. And either that day or shortly thereafter, someone took his one iron. And as the story comes to me, later on, there's this person that's going through a pawn shop and they see this golf club. And the center of the club is worn out.
And they looked at it,
did a little research, and it was Ben Hogan's one iron. Have you heard that story?
I have heard that story. I would have to believe that if you've heard it from your source and I've heard it from mine, I did not hear that from Mr. Hogan at all, but yeah. I've heard that story, Hale, yes. So I think you're right about it.
Well, you go back there now, where they use the tees and where you hit a one iron from, and then where they put the tees now and where they hit
eight irons from.
It's mind-boggling. The game of golf in yesteryear and the game of golf now, I don't know what the similarities are, except maybe in the clubs the way they look and the balls the way they look. That's it. The golf swings are the same. Nothing is the same.
No. And is it in fact, has it made the game better?
I guess my hesitation gives you an answer, doesn't it?
Well,
I think the rules of the game, Bruce and Mike, have lagged in keeping up with the traditions of our game. I've always felt like part of our game is the controlling of nerves and any kind of anchoring, any kind of something that allows that to be dampened, takes away from what the players of yesteryear did so well. They learned how to play the game and control themselves at the same time. The distance the ball goes now, and there are many players have been harping upon this for years and years and years. Yeah. And the governing bodies just don't want to hear it. And I don't see at the club level that it's really making that big a difference in the club level. In today's ball versus the ball of 30 years ago, I just don't see it. But Anyway, I could get off on that pretty quickly, so I'll try to step off the bandwagon right now.
Thank you for listening to another episode of For the Good of the Game. And please, wherever you listen to your podcast, on Apple and Spotify, if you like what you hear, please subscribe, spread the word, and tell your friends. Until we tee it up again, for the good of the game, so long, everybody.
It went smack down the fairway. Then it started to slice just smidge off line. It headed for two, but it bounced off nine. My caddy says, long as you're still in the state, you're okay. Yes, it went straight down the middle, quite a way.